Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of our radically democratic future. In my recent nanotechnology show, I pointed out that one of the challenges for creating nanoscale robotics is making robots that reproduce, since it would require trillions of nanobots to make industrial materials or troll our bodies for errant cells and viruses. The recent announcement that bacteria only require 300 genes to achieve life and reproduction is one such step towards merging the computing and robotics of nanotechnology with the reproductive machinery of biology. But single-celled organisms, while they can be very small, remember that mitochondria are single-celled organisms that got adapted into the ecology inside human cells, they are not nanoscale, for now. The January 18th edition of the New York Times carried a story on the discovery of University of Queensland researchers of nanoscale life that does reproduce. Their discoverers called them nanobes because their size is in the realm of nanometers, a billionth of a meter. At 20 to 150 nanometers in length, they are smaller than cells, smaller than fungi, smaller than the smallest known bacteria, and roughly the same size as viruses, which are considered non-living parasites because they need hosts to reproduce. Thus, nanobes call into question the minimum size requirements for terrestrial life. Discovered 4 years ago in ancient sandstone retrieved from an oil drilling site some 3 miles below the Western Australian seabed, nanobes were described publicly for the first time in late 1998. The fuzzy tangles of filaments resembled fungi and appeared to reproduce quickly, forming dense colonies of tendrils. Laboratory analysis of them repeatedly found signs of DNA, the master molecule of life. The colonies grow spontaneously, contain DNA, are rich in biological materials like carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen, and when cut in two, show distinct outer and inner layers, including a possible nuclear area that holds DNA. Stunning electron micrographs of the nanobes, printed in the November-December 1998 issue of the American Mineralogist, show riots of filaments and tendrils, their ends often swollen and suggestive of reproductive budding. Constrictions along some of the filaments most likely represent septa or cavities within the nanobes, the team wrote. Dissective cuts through the axes of some of the filaments demonstrate that nanobes have an amorphous membrane structure, the team said. Such an outer covering, the scientists added, is consistent with biological material and excludes the presence of crystalline mineral compounds. So these aren't a bunch of crystals growing. The colonies of nanobes grew so rapidly and so large, the team reported in American Mineralogist, that within weeks of becoming established on growth substrates, they became visible to the naked eye, appearing as dense colonies of opaque white, brown, or gray filaments. The topic of nanoscale life exploded in debate 4 years ago when scientists reported finding tiny fossil microbes in a 4.5 billion-year-old potato-sized Martian meteorite that crashed to Earth in Antarctica long ago. At 20 to 200 nanometers, the putative Martian fossils are smaller than any known terrestrial life, and that discrepancy quickly sowed doubts about the veracity of the alien life discovery. NASA asked the National Academy of Sciences to convene an expert panel. It met in the late 1998 and recently published a 148-page report, The Size Limits of Very Small Microorganisms. The 18 experts said that the known terrestrial bacteria in the range of 200 nanometers probably marked the lower size limit for current life, but held out the possibility that primitive, unknown microbes might have been as small as 50 nanometers, about the size of the Australian nanobes. Critics of the Australian claims point out that below 100 nanometers, there would be no room inside a structure for the chemical machinery necessary for reproduction, and suggest that the nanobes are actually parasitic on some other life forms or process, or functioning as a large distributed superorganism, none of which could reproduce by themselves. The Research Council's report laid out a detailed analysis of such a hypothetical communal life, calling the aggregate a metacell. Such organisms need not maintain a full complement of genes, one author wrote, referring to the basic unit of heredity. His own computer simulations, he added, predicted the existence of stable metacell components that held as few as a single gene. One may consider the metacell to be a single-celled organism whose genome is distributed through a network. And another one of the challenges of nanotechnology that I noted was the creation of molecular scale computing, which could be incorporated into the nanobots. In this week's Nature magazine, researchers at the University of Wisconsin-Madison have announced creating a short-lived computer out of strands of DNA. The team tethered the DNA to a solid surface and coded DNA strands to contain all possible solutions to a problem with 16 possible answers. Those DNA strands were fastened to a piece of glass covered with a thin sheet of gold, then bathed repeatedly in different solutions of enzymes that interacted with the DNA to weed out the wrong answers. Since DNA computing was first demonstrated in 1994, fewer than a dozen U.S. research teams have launched molecular computing projects. Together, they have a combined budget of only about $1 million. Laura Landweber, another researcher in this area, is working to exploit the computing potential of RNA. Her team recently fashioned RNA strands that processed complex problems similar to those that the chess players encounter. While Smith's team produced a chemical computer that tackled a problem with 16 possible answers, the Princeton RNA computer searched through 512 possible solutions, and her research will be published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. As I noted in the Brain Science show, one of the applications being eagerly anticipated by cryonicists and other life extension enthusiasts, and in the end, aren't we all life extension enthusiasts, is to make medical nanobes. We will eventually release swarms of trillions of reproducing nanobots in our bodies, programmed to repair and extend our body's ability to fight disease and forestall aging. Such swarms will perform genetic therapy, fix genetic illnesses, add new capabilities, perhaps control our autonomic functions or enhance pleasurable sensations. In the brain, these swarms could repair failing mental functions. People who had been frozen could be reanimated and their illnesses cured, while the nanobots knit back together all the neurons and other cells burst by the freezing. But why repair a mushy mass of wetware when you can upload to shiny new hardware? Nanobots could buddy up with each of your neurons and create virtual mirror of your brain function, a robotic electronic latticework around the existing wetware, which could then be uploaded into machines at the end of every day. If I die before I wake, please boot me off of my backup brain. Science fiction, you say? Wild lunacy? Better check out the webpage of the Neural Prosthesis Program of the Division of Stroke, Trauma, and Neurodegenerative Disorders at the National Institutes of Health. That's at www.nindsnih.gov/npp/. The federally funded projects listed there all involve connecting neurons to silicon or enhancing neural connections electronically. Work is proceeding on artificial cochlea for the deaf, artificial eyes for the blind, and electronic nerves to connect prosthetic limbs to nerves. One such project that was recently in the news is being conducted by Arthur Prochaska and Vivian Mushawar of the University of Alberta in Edmonton. They've developed neural amplifiers that increase weak nerve signals on the spinal cord, which may one day help paraplegics to stand or walk. The implants attach directly to the vertebra. A series of microwires made of an alloy of platinum and iridium project from the implant and are fed individually into the spinal cord. In people whose spinal cords are not completely severed, weak signals from the brain can still reach the legs, giving some people residual control over their muscles. Gerald Loeb, a biomedical engineer at the University of Southern California, has developed electrodes that are not much bigger than a grain of rice. At just 2 millimeters in diameter, they are small enough to be injected directly into a muscle using a 12-gauge needle. Once in place, they are activated by a radio signal from a coil worn by the patient. This controls the frequency and intensity of the electronic stimuli produced by each implant. That they act as artificial neurons and could herald a breakthrough in therapeutic treatments for stroke patients. The implants, dubbed bions, can be injected directly into muscles and stimulate them from within to prevent wasting away. The muscle wasting that afflicts many stroke patients can lead to serious complications such as thrombosis in bedridden patients. Unused muscles can also become so weak and flaccid that the arm dislocates from the shoulder. Once the bion goes in, you can evaluate what level of stimulation is required to get a contraction. Having determined the correct thresholds, doctors can then download a set of exercise programs into a portable controller for the patient to take home. The ultimate aim, says Loeb, is to design more sophisticated bions that can stimulate useful movements, allowing someone with spinal cord injury or a debilitating stroke to grasp an object with their hand. This will need implants that can sense movement and location as well as stimulating muscle contraction. Research is being conducted, for instance, on microelectronic devices that would be able to keep track of their relative locations on a person's body. So, for instance, your hand would know that it had reached the knee that it was trying to scratch. Finally, this electronic array of sensors and muscle contractors would need to be controllable in real time by the person themselves, at first verbally, or through a virtual interface, and eventually through direct mental interface. More exciting than making a broken meat puppet dance again, however, is replacing broken parts with shiny new electronic parts, the coming of the cyborg. Researchers at the Institute of Nonlinear Science of the University of California, San Diego, have built an electronic neuron which is able to work as a member of an organic neural framework. They began by studying the electrical code used for messages between 14 neurons that control the way that food is passed from the lobster's stomach to its digestive system. Then they bought dozens of California lobsters from a local fisherman. The target group of neurons was removed from each lobster, and microprobes were inserted to monitor the electrical activity. The signals passing between neurons turned out to be relatively simple, alternating between a fast current of about 50 hertz and a slow current of about 1 hertz. But it took about a year and a half to understand and model the patterns of impulses between those 14 cells. In living neurons, such signals are generated by the electrochemical transmission of sodium, calcium, and potassium ions. Using only $7.50 of electrical parts, however, bought at Radio Shack, the team built a device that could receive and transmit electronic signals at the same level. The next step was to remove a neuron from a biological circuit, generating an abnormal pattern of oscillations. The electronic neuron was then hooked into the circuit as a replacement. After just a couple of cycles, maybe a quarter of a second, they synced together and worked just as if the original neuron was there. We created lobster epilepsy, and then we cured it, according to one of the scientists. The next step, he said, would be to gradually replace all 14 neurons with artificial analogs and see if the electronic network can function like the biological network. Eventually, the researchers hope their work will contribute to the development of miniaturized devices that can take the place of damaged neurons. Most, and they shall make the blind see. A story that made a big splash this week comes from the recent issue of the Asayo Journal, a publication of the American Society of Artificial Internal Organs. Researchers at the Dobell Institute, led by William Dobell, implanted electrodes into the optic nerve of a 62-year-old man blind since age 36, known as Jerry. To use the device, Jerry wears sunglasses with a tiny pinhole camera mounted on one lens and an ultrasonic rangefinder on the other. Both cameras communicate with a small computer carried on his hip, which highlights the edges between light and dark areas in the camera image. It then tells an adjacent computer to send appropriate signals to an array of small electrodes on the surface of Jerry's brain through wires entering his skull behind his ear. The electrodes stimulate certain brain cells, making Jerry perceive the specks of light. The shifting patterns as Jerry scans across a scene tells him where light areas meet dark ones, letting him find the black cap on the white wall, for example. The device provides a sort of tunnel vision, reading an area about the size of a card, 2 inches wide and 8 inches tall, held at arm's length. Jerry can read large letters and navigate around big objects. That's enough to let him find a mannequin in a room, walk to a black stocking cap hanging on a white wall, and then return to the mannequin to plop the cap on its head. He can also recognize a 2-inch tall letter from about 5 feet away. Dobell's device uses a brain implant, while some other scientists are studying implants directly into the retina, a light-sensing tissue at the back of the eye. And if you go to www.caltech.edu/tilde-pinelab/netinadish.html, you can check out the work of a team at Caltech working on silicon neuronal prosthetics using colonies of mammalian neurons growing on a multi-electrode array. The array is used to communicate in both directions, providing the colony with an interactive simulated environment that reacts to and challenges the biological network, which can be imaged in real time. This is likely to provide data on dendrite formation in relation to stimulus, which is difficult, if not impossible, to study in vivo, but also opens the possibility of using biological components in ongoing computation. For instance, having a network filtering data provided from some electronic source and using the output as input to another digital program. And if you've seen the movie Matrix, you know that that's exactly what the giant computer program that took over the Earth was doing with all those human beings in their little boxes. Most of the research has been successful in coaxing neurons to grow into contact with microelectronic arrays, sending their dendrites out to communicate with tiny electrodes on open, latest computer chips. But a way of ensuring that the neurons stay attached to these computer chips would be nice. Enter Dr. Blaschuk of Ottawa-based Adherex, which is developing the biological glue and solvents necessary for attaching circuits to cells and teasing apart tissues for other purposes. The company's core technology is capable of manipulating the glue that holds tissues and cells together and has current applications in cancer therapy. A major obstacle in fighting tumors is that cancer cells are densely packed, so while the therapies kill the outer cells, the inner cluster remains intact. By breaking the cancer cells' bonds, the cells spread apart, making them easier to target. While there's been a lot of research into disrupting the ability of cancer cells to feed on the body's blood, Adherex technology is the first to target the blood supply line by breaking apart the vessels that feed blood and oxygen to the tumor. So far, the technique has shown remarkable success in tests on human breast, colon, and ovarian cancer tumors implanted into mice, and clinical trials are scheduled for next year. This same technique, he said, could be used to get drugs into the brain or could be used in surgeries where incisions could be made and then rapidly healed. Another potential application is body sculpting, in which fat molecules could be targeted so that areas of high fat concentration could be broken down and relocated elsewhere in the body. Like, for instance, I would have like the fattest lips in all of Hollywood. In the long run, it can be used to connect computer chips to the nervous system so that if a person has a severed arm and their arm doesn't work, you could attach attach an electronic device to the nerve, which would allow the arm to work again. Now, I download a lot of this information directly from the web, from various newspapers, and you can check out my method for doing that through the news tracker service of Excite if you go to my website, www.changesurfer.com, and search around there. I've got a page on all of the news tracking terms that I use. But I also subscribe to two lists, which provide precisely the kind of information that I just gave you. And those are at www.excelsior.org, Transhuman Tech List. The Transhuman Tech List is one of the lists I use. And that's Excelsior, E-X-C-E-L-S-I-O-R.org, /transhuman-tech-list/. And the other is the NanoGirl List. That is, Gina NanoGirl Miller maintains a web list for nanotech-related information. And that's at www.nanogirl.com. And I recommend those two lists highly. The January 18th New York Times includes a report that demonstrates what is blindingly obvious to some and totally opaque to others. If you are incompetent, you generally don't know it. Well, if you are competent, you know how much better you could be doing. And a series of studies published in the December issue of the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, doctors Justin Kruger and David Dunning of Cornell tested for incompetence. They found that subjects who scored in the lowest quartile on tests of logic, English grammar, and humor were also the most likely to grossly overestimate how well they had performed. Asked to evaluate their performance on the test of logical reasoning, for example, subjects who scored only in the 12th percentile guessed that they had scored in the 62nd percentile and deemed their overall skill at logical reasoning to be at the 68th percentile. Similarly, subjects who scored at the 10th percentile on the grammar test ranked themselves at the 67th percentile in the ability to identify grammatically correct standard English and estimated their test scores to be at the 61st percentile. On humor tests in which participants were asked to rate jokes according to their funniness, and those ratings were then compared to an expert panel of professional comedians and their ratings, low-scoring subjects were also more apt to have an inflated perception of their skill. But because humor is idiosyncratically defined, the researchers said the results were less conclusive. Unlike their unskilled counterparts, the most able subjects in the study were likely to underestimate their competence. The researchers attributed this fact to that in the absence of information about how others were doing, highly competent subjects assumed that others were performing as well as they were, a phenomenon that psychologists term the false consensus effect. When high-scoring subjects were asked to grade the grammar tests of their peers, they quickly revised their evaluations of their own performance. In contrast, the self-assessments of those who scored badly themselves were unaffected by the experience of grading others. Some subjects even further inflated their estimates of their own abilities. Incompetent individuals were less able to recognize competence in others, the researchers concluded. And the research meshes neatly with other work indicating that overconfidence is common. Studies have found, for example, that the vast majority of people rate themselves as above average on a wide array of abilities, though such an abundance of talent would be impossible in statistical terms. You can think of Garrison Keillor's All Children Are Above Average. And this overestimation, studies indicate, is more likely for tasks that are difficult than for those that are easy. This deficiency in self-monitoring skills, the researchers said, helps explain the tendency of the humor-impaired to persist in telling jokes that are not funny, of day traders to repeatedly jump into the market and repeatedly lose out, and of the politically clueless to continue holding forth at dinner parties on the fine points of campaign strategy, and of Republicans to continue voting, of course. Given our tendency to underestimate how slow other people can be, you may be surprised to discover that Christian practitioners of martial arts have only recently discovered that they have a connection to, gasp, Asian religion. So they are starting Christian martial arts studios, according to this article from the San Francisco Chronicle of November 22, 1999. Karate for Christ is taking hold in San Francisco, Florida, New Jersey, Nevada, Tennessee, Montana, North Carolina. Discussing a local instructor, the article calls Ray. He's a born-again Christian, sixth-degree black belt, and affiliated with the Liberty Christian Center in San Francisco. He talked about the moral lessons of initiative, perseverance, and responsibility. He says he does it because he loves the martial arts and felt there was a need for karate without any Eastern religious connotations. Ray often gets questions about whether karate is compatible with the teachings of the Bible. After all, it was Christ who said to turn the other cheek. Karate, on the other hand, was developed as an instrument of war. Furthermore, the martial art usually incorporates some aspect of Taoism, Zen, or Buddhism. I've heard a lot of comments that we're trying to put kids into Eastern religion, Ray said. There are interesting things to learn from Eastern religions, meditation, mind control over the body. Buddha was one sharp human being, but the bottom line is when he died, he died. Only one guy came back, and that was Jesus Christ. As far as turning the other cheek, Ray said that he teaches his students to do just that. We turn the other cheek, he said with a coy smile. We just do it before the other guy hits it. Well, if the Christians can learn from the Buddhists, so the Buddhists can learn from the Christians. Recently, many college-educated secular people were probably puzzled when a reporter asked George W. Bush in a debate whether he would take a phrase such as, "What would Jesus do?" into the White House. The phrase is apparently a craze among born-againers who wear bracelets with letters WWJD on them. So California-based Ulysses Press is selling books on wristbands labeled WWBD, What Would Buddha Do? I think it's a good idea, said Reverend Sukya Haju Sunim, resident priest at the Ann Arbor Zen Buddhist Temple. In Buddhism, there's a real emphasis on being mindful about what we're doing in each moment of our lives. Bryce Willett, marketing manager for Ulysses Press in Berkeley, California, says that he hopes his firm's $15 booklet and wristband will appeal to people from many religious backgrounds. Each book has a coupon to mail to Ulysses to receive the band. The book offers 105 answers to common WWBD questions. For instance, first thing in the morning, what would Buddha do about a coffee addiction? He'd switch to tea. It's more soothing. When driving to work, what would he do about road rage? He'd steer away from anger and make sure he did not contribute to the problem by driving too aggressively. Visit www.ulysseespress.com to read more about or buy the WWBD book and wristbands. Perhaps U.S. trade officials should buy a couple of those books and bracelets for Chinese officials next time they visit Beijing. China just is not having a good time with Buddhism. Last week, the 14-year-old 17th Karmapa, the recognized reincarnate head of the Karmakagyu sect of Tibetan Buddhism, and the second or third most important Tibetan Lama, escaped from Chinese-occupied Tibet to India in order to study under his reincarnate Lama teacher, Thai Sithu Rinpoche, who was this Lama's predecessor's Karmapa's instructor. This Karmapa had been officially recognized as the reincarnation of his predecessor by both the Dalai Lama and the Chinese government, an unusual concession of the Chinese since they have attempted to assert control over Tibetan enthronements and to enthrone their own Chinese-controlled lamas for about 1,000 years. The Dalai Lama is reportedly considering the potential of the boy as his successor as leader of the Tibetan diaspora and the Free Tibet movement. In retaliation, China announced that it had ordained a 2-year-old boy as the 7th reincarnation of the Rating Rinpoche. This is not recognized by the Dalai Lama. The 6th Rating, Danzin Jigme, who played a role in the administration of Tibet in the 30s and in the search for the present Dalai Lama, died in February 1997. The Xinhua news agency said the new tulku, or reincarnate bodhisattva, Sunim Puchang, was born in Lari, north of Lhasa, on October 13, 1997. And China continues to persecute Falun Gong, their own much more threatening Buddhist exercise movement that has been growing among the Han, not the Tibetan minority, and spreading even among Chinese party officials, that is, Communist Party officials. The government banned Falun Gong in July, rounding up its leaders and warning adherents to renounce the movement or risk punishment. Falun Gong, founded by Li Hongzhi, who left China and lives in New York, is a blend of Taoism, Buddhism, and Li's own theories. The government said the group was politically motivated and caused social instability, as well as the deaths of hundreds of people who avoided medical care due to their beliefs. Falun Gong had some 70 million members by one official estimate, making it larger than the 61 million member Communist Party. Chinese authorities sentenced members to labor camp and have detained thousands of others. An ongoing repression. Now, Japan has guaranteed religious freedom since they were liberated from fascist rule by American forces, and they have reveled in religious pluralism exuberantly, maybe a little too exuberantly. Since Aum Shinrikyo launched poison gas attacks several years ago, the Japanese have been on the lookout for Nazi cults. Their latest worry is a cult called Life Space. The cult is led by a scraggly-haired, silver-bearded former tax accountant claiming supernatural powers. It came to public attention when police removed a mummified corpse from a hotel room over the objections of his relatives, who claimed that he was still alive. Police said the family checked into the hotel in July and that Shinichi Kobayashi had probably been dead for several months before he was found last weekend. Members of the cult, however, said Kobayashi was undergoing treatment for an illness and required complete rest. "Until he was taken by the police, we believe he was alive," Kenji Kobayashi, the man's son, said after the body was cremated today. "We, his family, all believe that." To prove he was gradually recovering, cult members took photos of the corpse each day. The changes they claimed were indications of life. The corpse's darkening color, for example, were merely signs of decomposition, the police said. Police do not suspect foul play in Kobayashi's death, however, and no charges have been filed. Life Space leader Koji Takahashi, 62, described himself as a superhuman being who does not need to eat, wash, or sleep. His teachings blend elements of Christianity, Hinduism, and Buddhism with claims of telepathic powers and supernatural healing skills. Parliament is now debating an introduction of tough new laws to crack down on the Aum Shinrikyo doomsday cult, accused of killing 12 people in the 1995 subway attack. The new laws would allow the government to place Aum under surveillance and inspect its facilities at will. A related bill also would make it easier to seize the cult's assets. And finally, some good news coming out of the religion front. On January 18th, the president of the Unitarian Universalist Association and the president of the United Churches of Christ joined 850 clergy to endorse a new religious declaration on sexual morality, justice, and healing, a new progressive statement issued by SECUS, the Sexuality Information and Education Council of the United States. This document affirms that sexuality is one of God's most fulfilling gifts and outlines a new paradigm for sexual morality that does not discriminate on the basis of age, marital status, or sexual orientation. It opposes unsustainable population growth, the commercial exploitation of sexuality, and all forms of sexual oppression. The clergy represent a broad range of faith traditions, coming from 257 different denominations, and including the two denomination presidents, 15 seminary presidents and academic deans, theologians from more than 32 seminaries, and 14 bishops. The paper got slim backing among Roman Catholics, two nuns, no priests, and a handful of lay activists, a nun from major evangelical Black Protestant, Eastern Orthodox, Mormon, Hindu, or Muslim organizations. A local signatory is Reverend Lori Affont, a transgender activist who serves the Unitarian Fellowship of Storrs, that is in Connecticut. The Religious Declaration of Sexual Morality, Justice, and Healing calls for full inclusion of women, sexual minorities, in congregational life, including their ordination, and the blessing of same-sex unions. It also calls for sexuality counseling and education throughout the lifespan from trained religious leaders and a faith-based commitment to sexual and reproductive rights, including access to voluntary contraception, abortion, and HIV-STD prevention and treatment. Religious people need to think about issues of sexuality from the point of view of justice and equality for all, said John Burens, president of the Unitarian Universalists, who is one of the creators of the Declaration. And quoting Deborah Hafner, the Sikhist president and a UU seminarian, at the dawn of the new millennium, religious leaders are calling on faith communities to heal the mind-body dualism of the past 2,000 years. Our sexuality and our spirituality are inexorably linked. The Religious Declaration on Sexual Morality, Justice, and Healing, and a list of its endorsers, are available on the web at www.religionproject.org. Religious leaders who would like to add their names to the endorsement list also may do so at the website. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS-FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. Also check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.